Hello and welcome to a very special New Wave Heroes. On this show we meet Richard Evans, who is the author of the fantastic new book, Listening to the Music the Machines Make, Inventing Electronic Pop, 1978 to 1983. Richard has worked in the music industry for over 30 years in a variety of roles, including positions at London Records, Factory Records, and MTV Europe. In 1998, he set up marketing consultancy The Fan Base and has been connecting musical artists with their audiences ever since. He is the founder of the This Is Not Retro website and record label and has worked for Andy Bell, Vince Clarke, and Erasure since 2009. Drawing from years of extensive research, as well as from conversations with many of the personalities from that time, the book sets out to examine the many influences that led to the synth-pop revolution that spanned the late 70s and early 1980s. It tells the definitive story of a true golden age of British pop through the careers, records, and stories of the era's pioneers, mavericks, and chart superstars.
So 500 pages of facts, stories, memories. I mean, my first thought was you must have had a very musical childhood, a very musical background, and play loads of instruments. But that's not the case, is it?
It's not. No, none of those things are true. Yeah. It's like I'm not even quite sure how I got to this point, to be honest. But yeah, you're right. It's just over 500 pages, and I suppose it's kind of like a labor of love, isn't it? It's like you find something you connect with, you know, when you're younger, and then you sort of, it becomes part of the thing that makes you who you are at that time. And some of those things you just sort of, you let them go, don't you? You know, as you sort of move through life. But some of them just sort of stick to you. They're kind of too precious to let go. And this sort of music, this electronic sort of pop thing, was something that was too precious to let go.
Because this is only a second book, isn't it? So you've gone from a smaller version.
I have, yes.
And this is like the 12-inch version, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, that's right. And at this rate, I publish a book about once every 12 years. I suspect there won't be many more podcast interviews for the next one. Because we'll all be dead.
I say that. I was reading it. I mean, it's a fascinating read. And I was thinking, I hope there's not a test at the end because there's just so many facts in there, you know?
Well, if there was a test at the end, I'd be the wrong person to mark it because it's like, I don't remember all this stuff. It's like I've written it all down and I've put it all together. But there's too much of it to remember. So it's like, hopefully the book will be useful to people, you know, who can sort of have a read at the beginning, but then they can put it on the shelf and then put it down and think, there was something that I wanted to sort of just check on, you know, and it'll be in there somewhere. That's my hope, is that it will be useful to people as well as, you know, hopefully interesting and hopefully will take them to music that they maybe haven't listened to before.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I won't say when I was born, just down the road from you, I think. But I mean, obviously the sort of the mid-70s, the early 80s, that kind of thing. I mean, that's my thing, really. So, but even so, I learned loads from that book because
loads of things you didn't even know you needed to know.
I'll tell you what, how I was reading this. I was reading it and I had YouTube open at the same time.
Right.
You know, because you mention a band or a record, never heard of it. So
absolutely.
And you probably hadn't either at the time.
No, exactly that. That was kind of how my research process went. You know, it's like I would read about something and think, oh, I better have a listen to that because it's like, I don't even know what it is. Yeah.
No. But so, I mean, let's start at the beginning. How did you start to put this together? Because this is just so much in there.
Oh, God. I think it was because of the previous book. So the previous book was called Remember the 80s. And it was kind of like a big, bright, looking back at the 80s in a sort of pop culture sense. So it was like, it was lighthearted, loads of photographs, more photographs than writing, you know, if I'm honest. And, you know, it was like little interviews with people who were sort of defining the decade and stuff. And I got that book was offered to me, the opportunity to write that book was offered to me because I set up a website. Kind of like you've started doing. It's like to sort of pursue my own interests. And I'd set up a website back in 2002 called rememberthe80s.com because I realized that I love 80s music and lots of people around me loved 80s music. But at that point, there wasn't really anyone catering to those artists, but for what they're doing now rather than for what they did then. So that was the idea of the website. And it just happened to come through at the time when everyone was like 80s-tastic. You know, it was like all those sorts of big 80s tours was just starting, you know, and those bands were coming back and sort of coming back into the public view. And a newspaper interviewed me about this sort of resurgence of 80s interest, and the publisher saw it, and they looked at the website and they got in touch and said, we think there's a book in your website, you know, would you be interested in doing it? And I'd never thought about doing a book before. It's not anything that, you know, it seems like something that I could do. But I, you know, it's like, it was an opportunity and I hadn't done one before. So I said, yes. And I went through that process and it sort of did okay. And then people kept asking me afterwards, are you going to do another book? Are you going to do another book? And I really actually had no intention of doing another book at all, but enough people were asking me, every now and again, I'd sort of come across something. I think, oh, I wonder if I could write a book about that. this particular one came from, because I read all the sort of the music biographies. I love music biographies. So it's like there's loads of them from this era. You know, it's like there's Steve Strange, there's the Duran Duran ones, there's the New Order ones. You know, there's like Boy George and, you know, Nile Rodgers. It's like they're great. And I read them, and sometimes you realize that the way people remember things isn't necessarily the way things were. And I think that if you're a member of, I don't know, a successful band from the 80s, you've probably been asked about your favorite, you know, your first single or your third single or your, you know, debut album, like 1,000,000,000 times in interviews. And I think that because people get to talk about these things all the time, some of the detail from the original time gets lost, you know, and the story just sort of gets a bit smoothed around the edges, you know, because it has to be sort of become a media soundbite. And I started to realize that as I was reading books about the same period, different people had different views on the same situations, the same records, the same times. And I thought it's quite interesting that, you know, that there are these different views. I wonder what the real story is. You know, before these sorts of, you know, these sort of overtellings and revisions have sort of crept in. And that's kind of at the point where I started to think, oh, there's maybe a book in there. And it's like, you know, if I'm going to do that, then I kind of need to do it about the music that I particularly love and as I'm sort of immersed in, you know, professionally and personally. And so it became electronic music. And then it was like, you know, how am I going to do this? And I went to the British Library, and this was just a few years after the last book, so it was probably about 10 years ago, and I spent an afternoon there, and the British Library is fantastic, and you can go in, if you're a member of the library, and you can sign up for free to be a member, you can go into this room, and they've got like shelves and shelves and shelves, and you just pull these big, massive volumes down, they're like leather bound, and in it, there'll be like 3 months of the NME. You know, from 1977 or something. And so I just sort of sat down and just started turning the pages, you know, for 1978, and started, you know, having a think about it. And then I kind of didn't do anything with any of this information for ages, but in the back of my mind, it was just sort of, you know, swirling around a little bit. And I came to a point where I had a little bit of time in my working life. And I thought, I'm going to do something with that book idea. It's like, I'm either going to do it now, or I'm just going to let it go, and I'm not going to do the book at all. I'm just going to give up on the whole idea. And I got all those bits from the British Library back together, and I wrote sort of a sample section and put together a proposal, which went off to, fortunately, I had a friend who introduced me to a literary agent who specializes in music books, which was fantastically lucky. And he took it around some publishers and a few people were interested. And the book was signed up by Omnibus Press just after the start of the pandemic in 2020. And yeah, so that's kind of where it all came from.
So did that kind of slow you down? made it more difficult, yeah?
It kind of did slow it down, but it also sort of sped it up at the same time. It was a bit strange because all of a sudden people had more time on their hands, including me. And it's like I could concentrate on thinking about the book and writing about the book and reading up about the book. But what I couldn't do was go to the British Library. So it's like I didn't have access to the research stuff that I kind of needed to have access to. There's quite a lot of stuff online, you know, it's like, and I have, you know, a bit of an archive of my own, you know, of old magazines and that sort of thing, you know, the books that I've read that I talked about previously, you know, so I had stuff and there's like a lot of stuff online. So I could sort of start, I could make a start on it all. And I could start to work out how the book would fit together and the things that I wanted to include in it, you know, the records I wanted to write about and the bands that I wanted to write about. And so I was sort of writing stuff and then leaving gaps because I couldn't sort of finish them. So it was quite a bitty process because of the pandemic. But then once the British Library opened and I could start going there, I could still go back and start sort of filling in these holes, and it all, so it came together in a sort of a roundabout, an erratic sort of way.
So, do they allow you to? Do you kind of photocopy the stuff that you find and then bring it away? Bring it home?
They you're allowed to use a mobile phone. So basically, I just turn these pages. It's like The Enemy, The Sets with Sounds, and Melody Maker, and Record Mirror, and Smash Hits, and Number One, and Zigzag, and Flexi Pop, and you know, everything I could find. Basically, they covered 1978 to 1983. And every time I saw something, even if it was like a little mention. If it caught my eye, I would take a photograph of it. So my phone was like absolutely chock-a-block, you know, with pictures of pages from the music press from the early 80s. And those little bits became the pieces that I sort of, you know, used to build the book from.
Yeah, a few weeks ago I saw somebody advertising eBay. It was on eBay. They'd copied 200 copies of Smash Hits magazine and burnt them to a DVD.
Right, wow.
£15 it cost me, and I had 200 copies of Smash Hits from the late 70s.
That's what I needed in the lockdown.
Yeah. Well, I'm more than happy to send it to you, but this is probably a bit late now. But,
yeah, exactly. It's like I'm done. Yeah. I'm done with all that. Yeah,
somebody done all the hard work there, which was cool.
but it was great fun. You know, doing the research was great fun because, you know, an excuse to sort of sit down and just sort of like immerse yourself in that stuff as kind of as it happens, you're reading it as it happens, you know, and sort of seeing how these things fit together was really good fun. You know, it's the writing that's the hard bit. The research was good fun.
Yeah, linking it all together must have been really quite something, I'd imagine, when you've got literally thousands of facts and, yeah, and exactly. stories and screenshots. To put that together is...
Absolutely. Yeah, I probably got to about halfway through the book and I thought, there's too much detail in this. I can't keep it up. But then I thought, if I don't keep it up, then I've got to go back and rewrite the first half. So it's like I was damned if I did and damned if I didn't. So I just had to sort of plow on.
So the editor, did they take anything out or what was the...
The editor was fantastic, a guy called Nick Jones, who was brilliant. And obviously, like I said, you know, I'm not a writer and I haven't really written books before. So it's like I was probably quite a challenge because, you know, I didn't necessarily deliver the things in the way that someone who would be more experienced did. But he was very, very patient. He didn't really take anything out. He did sort of make great suggestions about how to sort of, you know, fit things together. And originally my plan was to write the book in just like one book in one piece. I would hand in like 50,000 words, you know, in basically one solid piece of text. And they're like, might want to put some chapters in. Like, oh, I didn't really think about that, but yeah, I guess we could do that, you know. So Nick and the rest of the people at the publisher were very helpful, very supportive, very patient of my sort of bumbling around in the background.
Yeah, that's great. So the book is very much about people and personalities. It's not actually about, I noticed there's not much technology in there, no synths, you don't go into any detail like that. Was that a conscious decision?
Yeah, a conscious decision, because I don't know anything about synths.
I think there's a second book here, right? it's called The Machines That Made the Music We Listen To.
Oh, that's so great.
You need to do a second volume of all the technology behind the first book, I think.
Yeah, but the whole technology, it makes my brain ache. You know, it's like, you know, there's so many technical terms and things, you know, within that world of synthesizers, you know, and people are so wedded to it. You know, people are really passionate about that stuff. And it's like, I don't feel that I would be enough of an authority to pull it off. Yeah, it seems like a very dangerous thing to try.
You should ask Vince to do it. He'll help you.
I should ask Vince to do it, but you know, he would just sort of shrug and say that I don't know how these things work. And he claims, Vince Clark, this is that we're talking about. Vince Clark claims that he's never read an instruction manual for any of the synthesizers he's ever owned, and he only works out how they play, how they work by playing around with them. So it's like it's entirely possible from his point of view that they can do like 1,000 things that he's never even discovered.
Well, I've got a quote here from Vince. It said, "We made it up as we went along." That sums it up, really, doesn't it?
No, that's absolutely true. And so many of the people in this book did. You know, at the beginning of the book, it was really interesting because it's like people coming on the back of punk, you know, which wasn't necessarily a musical influence, but all of a sudden punk allowed people to make their own music. You know, it's kind of, you know, it offered infrastructures. You know, you can press your own records, you can record them yourself, you can distribute them yourself. You know, it's like all of a sudden you don't need a record company or a record contract. You know, and that was really appealing to people who kind of didn't want to engage in a sort of corporate way, I suppose. You know, it's like that sort of, you know, punk attitude that we can just do this ourselves. And so all these people sort of picked up synthesizers, didn't really know how to use them, like Vince, you know, like the Human League, you know, like Cabaret Voltaire, you know, all these people sort of starting out, and they were literally sort of learning as they went, you know, just sort of, you know, putting this stuff down onto tapes. And I think this, although they didn't know it at the time, I think the simplicity of the things that they made are what makes them so brilliant still today. You know, it's like when you listen to those early Depeche Mode records, you know, it's like they're incredibly simple, but complicated at the same time and clever. Mm-hmm. But it's like, they still sort of twinkle today because I think they're not sort of drenched in corporate music. You know, it's like they haven't been overproduced. You know, they haven't sort of been through that, you know, that mill. You know, so I think it was quite a special and interesting time.
Yeah, there's definitely some naivety there. So I've got another quote here from Brian Eno. He used to stick post-it notes all over his synths for each what he nodded. One of the notes was a picture of a sheep that said it made the sound go all woolly. I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, that's right. And that's that. Funny enough, that quote comes from Ultravox, and Brian Eno produced the first Ultravox album. I think it was the first Ultravox. Certainly one of them. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was the first Ultravox album. So you see what I told you about, you know, not remembering the facts that are in the book. Brian Eno was the person who introduced Ultravox to synthesizers and the possibility of synthesizers. And he had, I can't remember what sort of synthesizer it was, but it basically came in a suitcase and you just sort of opened it up like a spy almost. And this synthesizer was in the suitcase. And I think it was Warren Cann from Ultravox who made that quote that you just referred to. There was a picture of a sheep on one of the keys because it makes the sounds woolly.
And also, I wrote this down, Joe Callis, when he joined the Human League, apparently Phil Oakey said he was the only one that could play with two hands.
That's right, yeah. Probably still is.
Yeah, well, they're still playing out, aren't they? Musicians Union, band since. Can't believe it, back in the day.
Oh, no, this is fantastic. Yeah. It is one of my favourite sections in the book, actually, because it's so bizarre. So the Musicians Union tried to ban since a couple of times, but crucially, in this particular story, it was in 1982, which is mind-boggling in itself, because, you know, there are so many of the sort of synth classics that we know of today. They'd already been through. They'd already been made. They'd already been huge hits. You know, it's like they were already part of the culture. And then Barry Manilow, of all people, went on tour, and he took a synthesizer which replaced his string section. And the Musicians Union decided that this was an affront to live music. And you can sort of see their point. You know, it's like, you know, you don't necessarily want to be putting, you know, eight people out of work, you know, for one synthesizer player. You can see why they were a bit scared. But it was kind of one of these fantastic cases of shutting the door after the horse had bolted. The Central London branch of the Musicians Union had a meeting, and over half their members voted to ban synths or ban synthesizer players from the membership of the Musicians Union, which doesn't sound particularly impactful. But if you weren't a member of the Musicians Union, then you often couldn't get the work. You certainly couldn't go on Top of the Pops or on the Old Grey Whistle Test or any of the TV shows that were happening on the BBC. Because Musicians Union membership was paramount, you know. So actually, it sort of presented all sorts of people with all sorts of problems. Thomas Dolby was one of the people who went to the meeting, and he wrote about it for, I think it was in Sounds magazine. And he said he turned up at this place and, you know, he encountered a bunch of blokes who he assumed were builders on their off time. And it turned out that they were the members of the Central London branch of the Musicians Union. And he couldn't quite believe that this actually happened, and it was passed, and it was recommended to the central, you know, body of the Musicians Union to sort of be made into policy. But there was a huge outcry in the press. You know, I think the media found it quite funny, and I think the audiences of the bands, you know, who were already out there making this music, found it quite funny. And everything just sort of quietly dwindled away. But for a while, it was quite a big story, and quite a funny one too. And all because of that Barry Manilow.
He's got a lot to answer for, that guy, hasn't
he? A lot to answer for.
Somebody else has got a lot to answer for was Gary Newman.
Yeah. Well, Gary Newman actually was someone who was very affected by the Musicians Union, because he even before this Barry Manilow debacle, Gary Newman had lots of problems because he was kind of the first synthesizer superstar. You know, he was the first one to really sort of break out and become, you know, an important force. The Musicians Union were very, very suspicious of him, and he had all sorts of problems. And I just mentioned that, you know, without Musicians Union membership, you couldn't go on Top of the Pops. So there he was with, you know, a number one single and a number one album. And it was touch and go whether he could, you know, make his Top of the Pops appearances, you know, because of the objections of the Musicians Union. I don't think I even know how they got around that at the time. But I suspect that Gary Newman's Musicians Union membership doesn't list him as a synthesizer player. Because kind of he wasn't, you know, when he started out, he was in a punk band. Tubeway Army was a punk band, and they signed to Beggar's Banquet as a punk band. Gary Newman knew that he didn't want to do punk forever, but he wanted to be signed, and he sort of used that as a sort of, you know, springboard. And then he found this synthesizer and got interested in electronic music. And then, you know, all these people like around the country who had been laboring on their, you know, electronic music masterpieces for a couple of years were shocked to find, you know, this guy, you know, suddenly pops up on Top of the Pops and he's number one and he's sort of stolen the march on everyone else. And he wasn't even a synthesizer player. He wasn't, you know, that wasn't his musical forte. You know, he was a guitarist.
Yeah, he did upset a few people, I think, because, like you say, a lot of people did all the groundwork, and all of a sudden he's number one on Top of the Pops with our friends Electric. That was the first time I saw him, which got me into synths and,
yeah,
you know, that kind of thing. And then the second time I saw him was on the Berserker tour, 1984, right. Ipswich, yeah. Gaumont. I don't know if you ever went to Ipswich Gaumont.
I did used to go to the Ipswich Gaumont, actually, because I grew up in Chelmsford. So I used to go up to it was like either going to London or go up to Ipswich. And I saw Toya at the Gaumont. I saw Susie and the Banshees at the Gaumont. I might have seen Big Country at the Gaumont as well. But yeah, around about that time, you know, that the early 80s, that was one of my venues.
And the third time I saw him was in Tesco's, like I mentioned to you before, because he used to live near me. He used to live around Stansted Way, I believe, somewhere around there.
Oh, that's right, yes. I think maybe that's because of the flying thing, wasn't it? It's like because he wanted to be in reach of wherever it was he kept his planes.
Yeah, we used to fly his plane over my house. And if I ever get to speak to him, I'm going to ask him why he flew it so close to our chimney, because it was...
He probably thought it was funny.
David, yeah. But, yeah. I was in Tesco's. It was in Great Dunmo. And I just come around the corner and he was in the freezer aisle. And I thought, that's Newman. And I'm a huge fan. And I thought, I just wasn't brave enough to go up to him. So I just stalked him along the freezers. And, you know,
what was he buying?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. We're looking at Turkey Twizzlers or something. Yeah, so I stalked him along the burgers and the frozen veg, and I lost him at the tills, I think. But,
yeah, it's ever so strange, isn't it? You kind of can't quite equate Gary Newman being someone who has to go to a supermarket. He's too otherworldly, isn't he?
Yeah, well, he's an American now, isn't he?
He's abroad, isn't he?
Still touring at the end of this year, but I couldn't get tickets. He's doing an acoustic tour at the end of this year, but I couldn't get tickets.
I didn't try for the acoustic tour, but I have seen him a few times over the last few years, and he puts on such a great show.
I saw him in Bristol about 3 or 4 years ago, probably.
Yeah.
Actually, I've got some more facts about Newman here, actually. Smash Hits Awards, 1979. This makes me laugh. He got the second best singer, which is good. He got the fourth place for Bore of the Year. And he got first place. He was the winner of Twerp of the Year. Now, I thought that was classic.
Yeah, he was a very polar character, I think, at the time. Yeah. And it's like, I think the thing that, something that people tell me over and over again about the book is people say, I can't believe how mean the press were at that time.
That's one of my facts on here.
And they were, you know, it's like they were extremely resistant to electronic music. But I think the person who bore the brunt of that more than anyone else was Gary Newman. He had such a tough time, you know, in the music press. You know, it's like he was derided by the sort of the old school of music journalists because, you know, I think really because they hadn't made him. Because he blazed through from nowhere. He didn't need the music press in the old fashioned way. You know, he just sort of, you know, come out of nowhere. You know, he hadn't paid his dues, you know, which I think was a very important thing in that sort of 70s culture of music. You know, it's like he hadn't, you know, necessarily done the whole pub circuit for 10 years, you know, and built the calluses up on his fingers and, you know, all of that sort of thing. So he had an awful time, but he was so successful and his fan base was so massively loyal and supportive, that he kind of won the polls for years after he was, you know, making hits, you know, because these people were sort of, you know, so loyal to him. But I think because he was such a polar character, there were so many people who hated him for all the same reasons that the other people liked him, that he would always appear in the good bits and the bad bits of the polls, depending on who was voting for it at the time. Yeah,
I think he still gets a hard time now, alongside Depeche as well, because they do. They've always been, for some reason, the British press have always had it in for Depeche Mode. No idea why.
Yeah, it's really strange, isn't it? But you know, it's like, but I don't think either of them care. You know, it's like they maybe cared a bit at the time. I'm sure they cared at the time. You know, because, you know, they were young and, you know, cutting their teeth, but I don't think they've cared for a long, long time, either of them. You know, I think they can both very, very boldly state that they don't need the press anymore.
Well, they let their music do the talking. So, I mean, I saw them back in May in London. They've got a new album which is, you know, it's great. I mean, 40-odd years later, and they're still doing it. Same as OMD.
Yeah.
They've got a new album just about to come out. They're still touring.
Yeah. And I think OMD are one of the best live bands out there. Yeah. I think that every single time they turn in a stellar performance. I've never seen a bad OMD show.
Now, going back to the Goemon, I did see them at the Goemon. They used to have this reel-to-reel tape machine called Winston.
That's right, yes.
I'll never forget. They came on for the encore. They had this tape player in the middle of the stage. This was for the encore, and it didn't work, okay? And they had, this is going back to the naivety of, you know, how we used to do things back in the day. But, so they had to queue it up, and it was quite awkward for them. But it's a memory that stands out, really.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think lots of people remember that. You know, they did that. Soft Cell did the same thing. They had a tape recorder on stage. And when Depeche started out, they had a drum machine. And it was like a little tiny box with like a dial on it. And I think Vince has still got it. And there's marks, there's little bits of tape on it. So that Dave Garn was the one who had to do the setting between each songs, and it was like there was like little labels telling Dave where to turn the dial for which song.
I saw a picture just yesterday actually of their synths. They were set up in milk crates.
That's right. Yes. yeah, and it sounds like the sort of thing that people say, you know, to sort of, you know, give it that authentic sort of, you know, vibe to what they've done. But there are actually pictures, aren't they?
And
they are genuinely just set their synths on top of a stack of beer crates. It's kind of brilliant.
Yeah, it's interesting that Neil Tennant, because he used to write for the press, didn't he? Smash Hits, and he obviously thought, I can do that, and he went on to form the Pet Shop Boys. So,
yeah,
he must have thought this is easy. I don't know what he was thinking, but
I think Neil Tennant's sort of musical aspirations were quite early on. You know, I think they preceded his journalistic career, but I think that he very definitely used his Smash Hits sort of connections to sort of move things forward. Because I think he went to America. He was sent to America by Smash Hits to interview the Police, or maybe see the Police play one of those sort of big stadium shows in New York. But what he wanted to actually do was he wanted to meet Bobby. Oh, I can't remember the name of the guy. He's an American producer who did disco records. Bobby something. Bobby G. Bobby V. So he set this interview up with this American producer, and that's where West End Girls came from. You know, it's like they had this song and they got it to him, and he turned it into what they wanted it to be, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah, well, he had a hell of a career on it, which is...
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I mentioned I saw Depeche just a few months ago. OMD is still playing out live, obviously, which is great. There is a massive kind of 80s nostalgia circuit now, isn't there? Which some of the original bands, I would suggest, probably like Human League, they've probably fallen into that nostalgia thing, whereas Depeche and... OMD, probably they're still at the forefront making new music, aren't they? So I'm not sure what differentiates the two. But
I think it's probably sort of the regularity of new material, really, isn't it? You know, it's like Depeche have consistently made new records, OMD the same. Human League, a little bit less. Yeah, it's like Human League have always been slow on making albums. You know, well, the sort of the Phil Oakey Human League, you know, without Martin Ware and the others, have always been fairly slow at making albums. But yeah, it's like this. It seems like the period is getting longer each time. You know, it's like, so I think they're very much more sort of sitting on their laurels, as it were. You know, whereas the other bands, you know, are going out in support of new material. And I think that's quite important. But I think it's also great that the new material is so solid. You know, it's like these bands aren't making lightweight weight records, you know, just as an excuse to sort of, you know, to be out on the. I think the money is to be made now on touring, and people make albums which enable them, you know, gives them the reason to tour. You know, so I think that there's a danger, you know, that the albums can be just a bit insipid, perhaps, you know, because the real reason is that it gives them a chance, this band a chance to go out and make some money. But I, actually, these acts, I don't think are making those albums. I think they're making really good, solid, artistic albums, you know, that they can stand by and they want to stand by. And, you know, I think that's really important and brilliant to see, you know, after all this time.
Because OMD's single Electricity, I mean, a lot of people point to that as being one of the most influential of the day, don't they, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I would agree. The other thing that stood out in your book was everybody references Bowie and Kraftwerk. Everybody.
Yeah, I think everybody started referencing Kraftwerk because Bowie did. You know, I think Bowie was such an incredibly important character, you know, to this generation of musicians. Yes, the book, you will know this, but some of your readers won't know this. The book sort of starts in 1972 when Bowie is on Top of the Pops doing Starman. And he points into the camera and he says, what's the line? My something is set on you. I can't remember the line anyway, but it was a moment that lots of different people have cited as a really seminal moment in their musical lives. So the guys from Duran Duran, Gary Newman was another one. Mark Arman from Soft Cell was another one. And so they were all watching this particular performance and they all felt that David Bowie was singing to them and he'd sort of created this sort of alien world that they wanted to be part of. And I think that because that was such a shared experience for this generation, that was the kind of the place that I started. And because he became so important to people, you know, people, you didn't just like him a bit, you know, it's like you loved him with Bowie. And because of that, they listened to the things that he said when he was interviewed, you know. So if he was saying, you know, I love this band called Kraftwerk, then these guys would go out and check out Kraftwerk because, you know, if Bowie says it's great, then it must be great. And so I think that in lots of ways, Bowie was, you know, unwittingly responsible for a whole generation of electronic experimentation. And not entirely, not just him, but, you know, I think that his contribution to that is one that should never be understated.
Wasn't there some friction between Bowie and Gary Newman, I think, somewhere?
There was. Yeah, there was. So Gary Newman came along and, you know, everyone said, oh, he's a bit like David Bowie, isn't he? including David Bowie.
Oh, really?
So it's like, I think that David Bowie was quite supportive at first. And then as Newman's success grew, you know, and sort of, I mean, it was extraordinary, his success in sort of 1979, 1980. I think there was maybe a little bit of, you know, of resentment crept in. And Gary Newman and David Bowie were both booked to appear. No, that's not quite right. David Bowie was booked to appear on the New Year's Eve edition of the Kenny Everett TV show. And Gary Newman, because he was sort of a bit famous by then, he blagged himself onto the show. He just wanted to watch, you know, it's like he was in the studio and he was watching Bowie doing his thing. And then apparently everything sort of stopped and someone had to come over to Bowie and say, to Gary Newman and say, actually, David Bowie would like you to leave.
Is that right?
Yeah. And, you know, it's like that I think that was a source of embarrassment to Gary Newman. He writes about it in his autobiographies. But I think Bowie sort of thawed a little bit because a little bit later on in his interviews, he started to be quite nice about Gary Newman again. So it did seem like a bit of a strange standoff, but a standoff there was.
So we're in the era of the tribute band, aren't we? Have you seen Tubeway Days?
I haven't actually, no. I know of them, but I haven't seen them.
Absolutely brilliant. They concentrate on the very early Newman stuff, so it was 79, 80, 81. You'd think it was him. It was just unbelievable.
Right.
Tubeway Days. Check them out on YouTube.
Yeah, definitely. What
do you make of AI? Because you're talking about machines. I mean, AI is the ultimate machine, isn't it? This is kind of as far as it can go now, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I haven't really sort of formulated a response to that question yet. It's like I find that AI is really interesting. You know, it's like I kind of love technology, and although I'm not like a sort of synthesizer head, you know, it's like I do like all that sort of stuff. And I admire the fact that we have technology that can do these things. I think it's quite scary, that it can imitate, but it can't necessarily create in the same way. So I'm sort of answering this question about music specifically. And obviously, you know, you can ask an AI interface now to sort of, you know, to create a piece of music in the style of X, Y, or Z. It seems that it can do that fairly well. But I think that it sounds like a cliche, but without the heart, I don't think it can actually sort of do that job. You know, it's just going to be sort of echoes of things that already exist rather than the new things in themselves.
Yeah, because it brings other problems like who gets the credits, who gets the royalties. It's just crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's like I wouldn't want to be a lawyer, you know, dealing with that sort of thing. But actually, that's probably quite a lucrative thing to be a lawyer in that area. Is probably quite a good thing. So actually, maybe I would want to be a lawyer looking into AI.
Yeah, career change coming up here. Well, that was fascinating. Thanks, Richard, for your time. Really interesting. Good to catch up.
Yeah, an absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much for your time, okay?
Thank you, Neil. Nice to meet you. Brilliant. Nice thank work. You.
Thank you. Cheers, mate.
Cheers. Thank you.
My thanks again to Richard. You can find out more about him and his amazing book, Listening to the Music the Machines Make, by checking out the website, inventingelectronicpop.com. Richard's other website, thisisnotretro.com, is also a great resource for everything 1980s and includes hundreds of interviews with bands and musicians that made the 80s so memorable. That's it for this show. Thank you for listening as always. See you next time. Bye for now.